Ephemeral is a production of iHeartRadio.
One of the most rewarding parts of this project has been getting to meet so many brilliant people, then plying them with questions. Turns out if you tell people you have a podcast, they will just talk to you and let you record it. One of the hardest parts is editing. No matter what, there is always too much great tape left over. These are some of my favorite heretofore unaired moments from four interviews of the past season. Though everyone is speaking on a different subject, one thing they all have in common is a passion for this work. Ian Nagoski is a music researcher whose label, Canary Records, does mostly reissues of music in languages other than English. The collection, To What Strange Place, the music of the Ottoman American diaspora, 1916 through 1930, introduced me to his work and became the basis for our season one episode entitled Diaspora. With the music, Ian has collected amazing stories of performers that otherwise may have been forgotten. Here is a little bit of his story.
I was a person who dug through records and went looking for old music ever since I was a kid. Sometime in my late teens, I started buying 78 RPM discs, just thinking there would be something maybe interesting on them, because I'd heard reissue records of old country and blues and jazz and that kind of stuff while I was growing up, and went and looked and, you know, started digging in flea markets and things, going like, well, why, you know, what is this stuff? Is there anything good on here that maybe I don't know about that I hadn't run into before? So I wound up intentionally buying anything that wasn't in English. And it turned out, yeah, there were some good music I'd never heard of before and that nobody I knew anything about. And I just started kind of gathering these things up real cheap, 10 cents a piece, dollar a piece. And over the years, I would play them for friends. And then eventually, I wound up with a lot of them. And I kept asking questions of people, do you know what this is? Is there a story here? And I started gathering stories that related to the records that I already owned. And then I started finding out bigger stories about how different ones of the records connected with one another. About 2007, I put out a CD. It was kind of a best of my record collection for a label called Dust to Digital. That record was called Black Mirror Reflections in Global Musics. And for that record, I wound up including in the liner notes the backstories to every record that was on there, you know, as much information as I could find out. In the process of learning those stories and writing those notes, I kind of developed some skills in research and have been sort of developing that ever since. So a little bit more than a decade now, I've been doing reissue records of old stuff in languages that I don't speak.
What's some of the variety of stuff that you're finding, I guess, in that early period?
I remember the first three records I ever bought at a flea market in Newcastle, Delaware. I got a Carter Family record on Montgomery Ward Records called The Cowboy's Lonesome Song to His Herd. I knew who the Carter Family were, and I thought that was a good title, so for 10 cents, I was good on that one. I got a record that was in Japanese that turned out to have been recorded in Hawaii. One side was called The Song of Ariang, which was a song about a sad pilgrimage in Korea. It was structured as a 12-bar blues, and it was in 3/4 time. So it was a 12-bar blues waltz in Japanese recorded in Hawaii. So
yeah.
I thought, well, that's interesting. And then the other record was a record by, they were then called the Bagelman Sisters. They were later renamed the Barry Sisters. And they were basically the Yiddish language Andrew Sisters during the 1940s. And yeah, they were pretty good. And the guy who sold me the records was this big, very, very stoned guy who looked at these records and looked at me. You know, I was 19 years old or 18 years old. And he just goes, Bagelman Sisters. You going to listen to that? I said, yeah, I think I will. And I bought a little turntable, a little like classroom turntable that same day for maybe like $10 at the flea market. Worked great. And So yeah, I just started picking stuff up, whatever it was. You know, next thing you know, somebody's yard sale, they've got a box of old records in Russian. And you go, how much for the box? And they go, $5. And you go, all right, let's figure out some Russian records. So one thing would lead to another.
So what, yard sales, estate sales, thrift stores? I feel like you've told me that you've literally pulled records like out of the trash before.
Sure, lots of times, yeah. A lot of basements, a lot of attics, you know, putting ads in, you know, hey, if you have any old records, I'd like to come look at them. And, you know, next thing, you know, somebody's polka collection, but, you know, old stuff. And you go, okay, well, you know, how much for everything? When I started looking into one particular story, I kind of put out an APB to everybody I knew who was a record head. By that time, I owned a record store myself. So I knew a lot of record people. And one buddy of mine, Angela Sawyer in Boston, wrote to me and she goes, yeah, I've got a bunch of stuff in like Turkish, I guess. It's been sitting under my TV stand for about 10 years. It's been maybe a dozen records. And I said, well, that sounds like maybe something I would want or need. And she sent me these records. They were all made by Armenians and Greeks and were big sellers in the Boston area where there were a lot of folks from that community. And I asked her, you know, where did you get these? And she said that in college she had a roommate who would pick up any records she saw on the side of the road that had been left out for the trash to take, just knowing that Angela liked old records. And because she didn't have any particular discrimination herself, this college roommate, but was just a sweet person, almost everything she brought her was, you know, moldy copies of Barbra Streisand records.
Sure.
You know, just the kind of stuff you would find in Goodwill. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while, there'd be something that was unusual. And Angela would dutifully, like, tuck that away because she's, like, an obsessive record nerd. And so for 10 years, these records in Turkish just sort of sat under her TV stand. And I said, you know, how much do you want for them? And she's like, no. it's not like that. These are for you, obviously. I've been holding on to them for all these years, not knowing it was you they were going to, but that's who gets them. And so a lot of records have come to me like that. A lot of people have seen that I was interested and cared when no one else was. And that's really how I wound up with a lot of them.
When did records that were immigrants from the Ottoman Empire start factoring into that collection?
Let me think. The first two records that I ever bought in Turkish, I actually bought both of them in Boston at a record store that happened to sell 78s and happened to sell 78s in languages other than English sometimes. One was a record made about 1916 by a violinist named Naim Karakand. The other was a record made about 1926 by an oudist and singer named Achilles Poulos. They were both 50 cents plus tax at a record store called Stereo Jacks. So those were things that I just had kind of lying around as, well, this is neat and cool. Didn't know what they were, didn't know what they meant. And years later, when I stumbled across a couple of boxes of records in Greek, I noticed that the recording dates and record label catalog numbers were roughly about the same. You know, they must have been made about the same time, the same place, the same studios, I figured out, in New York City. And I go, like, wait, did these people know each other? Was this part of a scene? Was there a community here that maybe was happening that I haven't heard about? And started asking around and looking for stuff that had been written and couldn't find much of anything. But with enough asking around and enough reading, I figured out that, yeah, that's exactly what had happened. There was, in fact, a community of immigrants from the Near East. And these records were made by people who, if they didn't know each other directly, certainly knew people in common and lived in the same world and had very similar experiences of being immigrants to the United States at the same time.
Thank you. David Weinstein is a media historian and author who serves as a senior program director for the National Endowment for the Humanities. Without his book, The Forgotten Network, Dumont and the Birth of American Television, and his years of dogged research, tracking down old kinescopes of long-lost broadcasts, our Dumont episode would have never been possible. The Dumont Television Network was once a household name, but in 6 decades off the air, it has fallen into deep obscurity. I asked David what it was about this dusty corner of history that so captivated him. Say hello or something so we get a little mic check for you.
Hi, Alex. Dumont is the greatest network ever. It did all kinds of amazing, amazing things. It invented sound. It invented video. It invented audio. It did everything.
It's ironic that the Dumont name is like the punchline of jokes about antiquity, right? Being that they invented so many features that are just like, oh, they were the first ones to do that? Everybody does that now.
Yeah, certainly with network broadcasting after the war, Dumont and NBC were the first ones to even think of a television network, the idea of broadcasting the same program in multiple cities. And Dumont did it in New York and Washington and was very much focused on building that national network. They were among the first to do any kind of television programming. They were especially creative during World War II in preparing for the post-war explosion in commercial television. They were also innovative in their daytime schedule. They were innovative in some of their business models. For example, rather than a single sponsor paying for and controlling the whole program, which was the radio model that went into television, Dumont chopped up its program into multiple sponsors, each of which would have a short segment, which is really the forerunner of television advertising as we knew it for much of the network era. Dumont also had tons of just creative programs, many of which we've talked about, shows like The Plainclothesman, Cavalcade of Stars, even Captain Video, I think really belongs in that category. So, I mean, this may sound weird. I wrote the book between 1999 and 2004. I was younger then, and I was really into punk rock and indie rock, and I almost saw Dumont as a punk rock television network, even though I didn't write this. The television itself was very punk rock. And what I mean by that, it was Dumont was young, creative. They were an underdog. They were an outsider in the industry, underfunded, low budget. But they were really creative. It was almost amateurish at times. But in that amateurism, you found a lot of really cool, interesting stuff. There was a sort of independence among the people who worked there. And there was certainly a community from what I've learned in talking to people at the network, but there was also a sense that in watching the shows, you were almost part of this sort of weird little community of people who were into the same things that you were, whether it was Captain Video, and then there was the merchandise related to that, or whether it was some of the other programs that even now sort of have a cult following among TV collectors, among, you know, people into old-time television. It had this sort of, many of the Dumont programs had this sort of weird niche following that continues to this day.
Oh, Don, this is a thrilling night tonight. What are you dressed up for? Going to a funeral?
Well, you know.
What are you made up for, kid? Wow, all my friends are here. I see Andy, Mary, Cal, people from Los Angeles, the Gordons. All my friends are here tonight. Right. Means no minimum. You can't make a dime.
I think it really did come out of not just punk, but just in general, sort of liking to mine the history of pop culture for things that have been forgotten and don't deserve to be, whether it's old music, old movies. I've never been the kind of person who just sort of flips on the commercial radio station and that's it. I like to figure out where things came from, the origins, and sort of cool stuff that has maybe been overlooked. And Dumont certainly fit that bill. And as I learned more, I sort of became seduced by some of the programs. In some cases, it is because so much of it was live and ephemeral, and even the hunt to find them. And then seeing things that I felt people hadn't seen in years in the live programs, that was worth seeing, that was really cool, that was really inventive, that helps understand how television became so popular. When I was doing the research, there was still a sense of television had a golden age, and they were sort of dramas that were on the other networks and stuff like Marty, stuff that had, you know, survived, that was pretty easy to find, or stuff like Milton Berle or Ed Sullivan. And I wanted to dig a little bit deeper and see what else was going on. And I get excited when I find cool, different stuff that helps me connect the past and the present.
There's no comparing the joys you'll be sharing with Dumas. Dumas.
Sarah Wasserman is a professor of English and Cultural Material Studies at the University of Delaware. She has a book coming out in 2020 called The Death of Things, that looks at ephemera in 20th century American fiction. I asked her how she ended up as the ephemera teacher.
Part of it is just that you start doing one thing and it has all kinds of offshoots and rabbit holes. And if you're curious and maybe a little nutty like I am, you tend to follow them instead of staying on one focus. But it really started, you know, I did a PhD in literature in an English department, and I was reading all of these novels, all these American novels primarily, and I was thinking a lot about why there was so much stuff in these novels, and then in particular why there's so much disappearing stuff. You know, why are novelists writing about pop-up buildings and paper that disappears and stamp collections that go missing and things like that? So it started from being someone who liked to read and studying literature in a scholarly way, but I wanted to understand why there were these objects in books, in fiction. And that sort of led me to doing this material culture stuff. I'm not someone who goes primarily to a museum and looks at, you know, American pewter or a line of teapots. I'm thinking about why authors are writing about those objects. But in trying to do that, obviously, I've learned to kind of go to the archives, go to collections, look at things that authors might be writing about and try to make sense of it that way.
Working with ephemera is hardly ever glamorous.
When I was in grad school, I did this dissertation writing boot camp over a break where they like lock you in a room and you have to write. And the way they started it is we all sat around a table and everyone had to go around and say what they were working on. And this was at Princeton, brilliant people, and everyone's going around and saying what they work on. Oh, this is a project on the Revolutionary War, whatever. And the woman next to me said, I'm writing a dissertation. It's a comparative literature dissertation that looks at Chinese, French, and German literature, and it's about the concept of everything. So when did writers start thinking about the totality of the world? And I had to go after her and just said, yeah, I'm Sarah, I'm writing a dissertation about trash. So, you know, it's important to be humble. So I think that these objects do teach us a lot and make a lot of meaning. But I think part of what you're saying in your pitch is that they can be overlooked and they can be seen as minor. And so they don't enter the history books as much. We need these other formats to explore them.
Sarah's interview forms the basis of our episode, Ephemera What? One of the topics we mention is the 1939 New York World's Fair and the souvenir craze that accompanied that ephemeral event, which gave me the opportunity to inquire about Sarah's own collection.
After you came out of Futurama, which was General Motors' vision, sort of model city of the future, you would get a little button that says, I have seen the future.
That'd be a great button to have. Do you have one?
I don't have one. I have a bunch of ephemera. You know, when you start to work on ephemera, people come and give you ephemera as presents. So I do have quite a lot from the 1939 World's Fair, but I don't have one of those pins. They are actually pretty desirable collector's items because not many of them are left, right?
Please give me just a little audio tour of like some of the ephemera that you have.
Oh, gosh. So I have a lot of, I don't know how to describe these. They're not really a genre that's around anymore. So from the fair, I have a lot of souvenir booklets. So they're really interesting because, I mean, it's the 1939 fair, so they're mostly drawn, as you know, they're not photographic records, and they take all different forms. So they're like fans with a photo of the Perisphere and the Trilon were the two iconic buildings, and they get sort of put on everything. And there's a lot of, you know, little drawn books that tell you about the different exhibits and their fans. I think I have a kazoo, a sewing kit from the fair that someone gave me. And then going forward to some of the other ephemera that I talk about that I've managed to sort of get for my own nerdy collection, I have a bunch of stamps. So I think I have all the stamps that Philip Roth writes about in his novel, The Plot Against America.
How many stamps is that? I haven't read the book.
15 or so, I want to say. And they're pretty unusual, most of them. So for reasons that I won't necessarily go into, the main character, also called Philip, collects stamps. And he's interested in, obviously, the ones that are more valuable, which tend to be like things with errata. So, you know, the plane in the middle is printed upside down because when they put the stamps through the printing machine the second time, they had it positioned the wrong way, things like that. So I have some stamps. I have an interesting, I write about Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, which some of your listeners will know, not as a novel, but as a TV show. And in the novel, there's this thing called Cards of War from during the Second World War, which are, they're like playing cards, I guess. And on one side, they depict a really gruesome illustrated scene from a war. And on the reverse side, there, you know, there's details about what this battle was or what this military maneuver was. So they really range from, you know, the lovely little kazoo to the grim war cards.
Did you collect ephemera before you became the ephemera teacher?
That's a good question. So my answer would be no. But upon thinking about it, I'm not a collector. I'm a pretty minimalist person. I don't need to Marie Kondo my house because I've already tidied as I go. We could talk about Marie Kondo too, but I think about my childhood, and I think many adults who don't collect in their adult life were collectors as children, and I certainly was. I had a sticker album. I had things that were maybe less ephemeral, like a collection of troll dolls, a collection of Bonnie Bell lip smackers. I like things that you could organize by color. So now I don't collect things like that. I do, though, have a small collection of strange fortunes from fortune cookies. So fortunes with typos or very odd phrasing in them. But other than that, no, I was not into ephemera before I started this research.
Do you have a favorite strange fortune?
Oh, my favorite one is probably this one, which just says, "You are always on our minds."
Wow.
I like
good
that
to
it's
know,
plural.
I guess.
Yeah, it's collective. Someone's, you know, multiple people who made that cookie are thinking of me.
I don't know. You maybe would have rather not gotten that message. One more thing. When we recorded the interview earlier this year, it seemed like everyone was cleaning their homes because of a new show on Netflix.
I'm really interested in the fact that Marie Kondo is this juggernaut right now. And it's not like in the early aughts we had Hoarders, the TV show Hoarders, right? And it was super pathological. It was like, look at this person and all the things they haven't thrown away and the cat that died and they didn't even notice because they have too much stuff. And Marie Kondo is not that, right? Marie Kondo is the show that's done with love and care. And it's a really non-pathologizing show about people letting go of their stuff. So I wonder, as I'm finishing this book, and it's something I've been working on for a long time, too long, really, if there is a shift, if the tide is turning, and it might be linked to some of the things that you mentioned earlier about digital technology and people getting more used to living among less stuff. But I just think it's a really... the time is ripe for this question, for this show, for these considerations of disappearing objects. And I think that the Marie Kondo is a sort of symptom of that.
Elizabeth Cobbs is a historian with more qualifications than I could hope to list. Stopping through Atlanta on tour for her newest book, The Tubman Command, she joined me in studio to talk about her 2017 work, The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. which tells the stories of brave souls who enlisted as telephone operators for the U.S. Army Signal Corps during World War I. Our conversation became the episode Switchboard. We actually had finished the interview and were standing outside the booth when we got to talking about ephemera specifically. Elizabeth asked if we could jump back in to record it, and that's where the following piece of tape comes from. The way she talks about a historian's job of reaching into the past is, for me, what this whole endeavor is all about.
One of the things we do as historians is we look at ephemera, which we consider to be the tangible material objects that surround documents. So one of the ephemera that the Hello Girls had, which to me was so indicative of their sense of humor, I was at Mark Ho's home and looking at the things he had collected of the Hello Girls. And I found, he said, look at these tiny binoculars. Now, these tiny binoculars look like the size of a penny, like a little tiny charm bracelet, kind of charm that you might wear in a bracelet. So I said, oh, well, those are cute. Aren't those cute? And I put them back down. He said, no, really look at them. Look through them. So I lifted up these tiny souvenir binoculars that one of the Hello Girls had brought back and shown to her friends. And I could see there's a little glimmer of light. And I said, oh, yes, well, I can see light comes through them. And he said, no, really look through them. So I looked through them. And on one side of the binoculars, there's a naked lady holding up a mirror and looking saucily at the viewer. And on the other side of the binocular, there's two naked ladies who are standing in a mirror. In other words, it's French pornography. And so these Hello Girls had this just wild sense of humor, you know, that they brought back all kinds of souvenirs, letter openers and, you know, books and such things. And even, yes, even a little French pornography for the heck of it.
That's
they
awesome.
I'm telling you, the optics on this thing were amazing. And that's now, by the way, all at the World War I Museum in Kansas City. All of these things that are indicative of the women's experience, you know, from their uniforms to their trench helmets to their gas masks to their mess kits to their crazy little French pornography, which they found apparently very amusing. At least one of them did.
When you went out and found these diary specifically is what I'm thinking, because there's lots of diary entries. I mean, what do you get to see the actual?
Well, yeah, this is the interesting thing, because since there was no effort really to collect these women's experience, I had to go all over the place. I had read that there was this attorney, so I tracked him down in Seattle and flew to Seattle one day, and he had some boxes, and we went through them. And in one of his boxes, I found a diary. And on the diary, it had a phone number. So I first of all, read this amazing diary that no one had ever seen before. And then I called the phone number that was on it. And that went to somewhere in Sausalito, which is in California in the Bay Area. And that was a man who said, oh, yes, well, my aunt was a Hello Girl, and I have her records. So I went and looked at that group of records. And in that, there was a memoir. In fact, that was where I found Merle Egan's memoir. And then from all of that, then I began to think, oh, I've got to get Grace Banker. I've got to get the woman who led the first contingent. It was sort of my holy grail. And I have a friend who's an absolute crackerjack investigator. And I said, can you find me a descent of Grace Banker? And she called me the next day and she says, I think they're in a nursing home in New Hampshire. So then I'm on the trail of something in New Hampshire, and I get on the phone and call this man, old man, who calls me back and says, well, yes, my mother-in-law was Grace Banker, and she passed away a long time ago. And I said, do you have anything of hers? And he said, well, we have a diary. Now, I had seen references to a 10-page diary excerpt that Grace Banker had once published, and I thought it might be the whole thing. So I said, how many pages is it? And he said, well, it's about 90 pages. And so then I knew I had a book. I knew I had a book because I had Grace Banker's diary, the diary of Bertha Hunt, who was a Signal Corps operator from Berkeley, California, and Merle Egan's memoirs. And that, combined with the Army personnel records in St. Louis and the Army records in the United States archives in Washington, D.C., and then the newspaper records, you know, I was on the trail of a real book.
When you've got that diary and you're really literally like holding it, right? And you're maybe the only person that's ever read it, or at least read it in what, 70 years or something?
We read it maybe 100 years. I mean, people, you know, Grace Banker came back and she put it in her trunk. And I was talking with her granddaughter when I was first telling the family about my interest in their, you know, their mother or grandmother. And she said to me, Carolyn Timby, she said, well, I have my grandmother's trunk, but I've never looked in it. So I said, oh, my gosh, do you have FaceTime? I have an iPhone. Do you have an iPhone? And so we bring each other's faces up and we're talking to each other and looking at each other. And I say, well, can I see the trunk, too? So she walks me on my iPhone into her grandmother's store in the family storage. And there's a green trunk, this green leather army trunk that's stamped U.S. Signal Corps and Grace Banker. And she lifts the lid. And there's Grandma's stack of letters, and there's Grandma's trench helmet, and there's Grandma's, you know, gas mask and mess kit and uniform. And this trunk has not been opened in we don't know how many decades. And suddenly it's just all there. It's like this, you know, magic trunk.
It's like a treasure chest.
It is. And so the family has now donated most of it to the World War I Museum in Kansas City. But I think there are pieces of it they just can't unclench their fists and let go of, because it is, you know, it's this treasured memento.
But there's something like holding that handwritten note that who knew if it would ever be read again, and maybe, you know, you're seeing it for the first time in 100 years. It's like do you feel like a psychic link back?
I do. Here's a weird thing. The historian in me, it's like the dead are present with us. You know, they are. We'll be dead too. Soon enough.
And we'll leave our own ephemera.
So I always feel like writing history is like reaching through this beaded curtain and holding someone's hand who's on the other side, you know, and trying to bring them closer so we can see them. Hope that doesn't sound too ghoulish, but to me it just feels very intimate and personal. With every book I've written, you know, it's always, I'm there to meet them. I'm there to meet Harriet Tubman, you know, I'm there to meet Alexander Hamilton. I've written a couple of novels on those and some other people as well. And I always just, you know, I feel my mission. The mission of a historian is to get the dead to stand up and walk. You know, tell the story.
My sincerest gratitude to Elizabeth Cobbs, Sarah Wasserman, David Weinstein, Ian Nagoski, and all our other amazing guests this season for lending their credibility to our fledgling podcast. Finally, we wanted to say thanks to you for, instead of the infinite amount of other things you could be doing, choosing to listen. Without you, there is no show. If you feel so inclined, drop us a line, write us a little review, hit us up on social media. We'd love to hear from you. Learn more about everything you heard here at ephemeral.show. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.